Welcome to the Health Tech Podcast. Here we talk about everything healthcare and technology. And I'm your host, James Summery.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Health Tech Podcast. Back with me, I actually forgot which podcast I was on there and almost said Health Tech Pigeon, but back with me today, I have got Max Parmentier, founder and CEO of, or co-founder and CEO of Birdie. Max, you've been on before, I guess, for those people that didn't or haven't listened to your last episode, just give us a quick rundown, who you are, what you do, what's Birdie, and then we'll get into what's happened since last time.
Thanks, James, and thanks for hosting me once again. Lovely to be back in the podcast. So I'm Max. I'm the CEO and one of the co-founders of Birdie, and Birdie is a home healthcare technology platform that aims to radically transform the life of older adults. We are only one solution supporting millions of care visits every month, equipping care providers with the tools they need to deliver more personalized, preventative and holistic care at home.
Beautiful. So something that you said there, transform the lives of older adults. I think one thing that has always, I remember our last conversation actually, what this was a long time ago actually that you were on the podcast, wasn't it? It was like, we're talking years maybe. This point about genuinely transforming lives of older adults. It's not just necessarily specific health metrics or things like that. Your vision has always been about how we age and how we live as older adults. And I think that's one thing that has always sat with me. I can actually remember where I was when I listened back to that episode. And I was like, oh God, I was actually on holiday. I was in Barcelona. I remember listening back to our episode in Barcelona and being like, hearing it the second time. I needed to hear it all second time round for it to actually sink in. But one thing that I've loved is this vision that you've had. So I guess for the people listening, it'd be really nice to talk about this vision that you've got for us aging and how we age, very specifically how we live as older adults as we age, what Birdie is doing to support that vision or realize that vision, and I guess like how that might have changed since we last spoke, if indeed it has.
No, it has changed a lot, because I think we've been understanding much more what's at play overall in our health and care system, but also the needs and the wishes of the aging population as well. And so maybe it's worth repicturing a little bit what we have seen and what we have understood over the last few years since we last spoke, because it's quite, I think, compelling as a context to understand where we're heading. So let me give you a bit of the perspective we got. Overall, what's interesting when we talk about an aging population, we understand that the needs of that population have evolved a lot over the last couple of decades. And very interestingly, when you talk about healthcare and you look at healthcare costs, and James, obviously you're aware of that, we are facing a quite challenging situation in terms of costs. Healthcare costs across Western societies are soaring. That kind of about 10% of the GDP today. In some countries, we expect it to be 20% of the GDP. It's a huge budget. In the UK, it's 40% of the UK government budget if you remove allowances. So it's a significant bucket of costs. And one of the driving factors of this increase in healthcare costs, which become unsustainable, is the fact that we have an aging population with very different needs. 60% of the healthcare costs today are spent on the elderly, and we have a population that falls sick at the same age but dies later, and therefore we have a growing cohort of dependent, frail elderly with an entirely different set of needs to be properly supported and to live as they want. And for us, the understanding of that was very critical, because we are facing an unsustainable cost in front of us. Obviously, we cannot support and accommodate such soaring healthcare costs. Every policymaker we talk to agrees with that statement. But the real question is then, how do we really cater for the needs of that population with very different conditions than 50 or 60 years ago when we actually designed our healthcare systems? And let me go back because it's quite interesting. You know, in 1948, when the NHS was created in the UK, but frankly, it's a bit of the same in other Western countries. The needs of the population then were very different. People were dying or falling sick because of episodic diseases. And it was, you know, typically you have pneumonia, you go to the GP or to the hospital ward, you being diagnosed with pneumonia, and then you are being prescribed medication and you're back on your feet a few days later. The truth is, we industrialized our healthcare system based on these very specific needs to accommodate as much as possible, the population needs. And really, it was the idea of universal health coverage, where everybody should have access for free to healthcare at a point of service, but for these specific needs. And so it was very much industrialized and centralized. And that worked for quite a long time. But now fast forward 60 years later, as I said, the bulk of the cost and the needs sits with an older population with very different conditions, essentially long-term conditions and chronic diseases. And we know that there's plenty of literature and evidence supporting that. But about 60 to 70% of the people today die because of these chronic diseases and long-term conditions. And that's essentially the elderly. It could be dementia, diabetes, hypertension, cancer, all of the above. Conditions that usually you cannot cure, but you can live better with. And yet, we have a healthcare system that's very reactive because it's still, you know, based on the premise of what we needed 60 years ago. That discrepancy is very apparent. It's very, very compelling when you go into an emergency department and you see that 70% of the department is filled with older adults who had an issue, a condition that's worsened, are being admitted to the hospital, you know, stay for one third of them for 4 weeks in the hospital, where they probably, you know, deteriorate even further, are being discharged, and then the readmission rate is very, very high for these people. And so that means we really have a vicious circle where we intervene too late in a very reactive fashion. We prescribe medication way too many often because we don't take a holistic approach to these conditions. And therefore, these older adults deteriorate and worsen way too fast, and yet it costs a fortune to the system. And so that's really what we realized going on site, talking to GPs, and to old adults, and realizing that really this system is not fit for purpose. Now, you know this better than I do. There's not a single policymaker or health secretary or NHS long-term plan that doesn't prescribe a much more preventative, personalized, holistic model of healthcare. Patient-centric as well. That means often in the home where the patients live. And it's obviously very clear that this is the way forward to come much earlier in the journey of care of these patients, where you can actually intervene much earlier with these conditions, help these patients to live better with these conditions on a day-to-day basis, personalize the care based on their condition, but also their wishes and how they want to live, and really work towards prevention, because there's a range of opportunities today to identify much earlier a range of problems that, you know, arise, and avoiding hospital admission by all means. And so this is really where we have a strong conviction. Our thesis is that healthcare will move towards where patients live, that's at home, in a much more personalized, preventative, holistic fashion. And if you think about how our healthcare system is organized, we believe that care in the community will be the future primary care for these patients, which represent the bulk of the cost today. Caring for these patients where they live by the community, be it care professionals, family members, neighbors, GPs, nurses, physios, but really this tight coordination of a network of care in the community will be the right way to care for these patients with these conditions, to make sure that they live much healthier, much longer in their own terms, but also that you bring the cost down to the healthcare system. And that's what we're working on. And that's, you know, what we call the village of care. Equally to how you would, you know, say it takes a village to look after a child. We really believe that it takes a village to look after an older adult, and rightly so. It used to be that the case before. And that's how you're going to basically keep that population in much healthier condition and bring the cost down. So that's where what we're aiming for.
So, yeah. So if I've understood this correctly, then that was a heck of a monologue, by the way. That was absolutely glorious.
I'm quite passionate about the topic, as you know.
Yeah, I can tell. Well, I remember our event that we did at Google where that passion came out as well. I think what you're talking about is changing an entire model of care, and almost changing like a philosophy of care, isn't it? Where, like, historically the hospital is at the center. You're ill, you go to the hospital. Everything happens at the hospital. What you're talking about is the care is the individual. The individual is at the center, and geographically, the individual is at home. They are at home with their life, by the way, which is their bad knee and their diabetes, and their all of that exists in the home because they exist in the home. So do their hobbies. So do things that bring them joy. And actually, what you're talking about is this change in philosophy where, why aren't we respecting the fact that this person, this individual, and who they are in their life and everything is in the home? And why can't we be supporting them as they age to continue with their life how it is? Now, my question is, on a very practical first principles level, the NHS is the system. That is the system, which is this, whether it's primary care centric, GP centric, or hospital centric, or system centric, you go to the system, right? Like that's what we're talking about here. Now, where is Birdie's role in changing this system from where it is currently at scale with this, you know, hospital centric geographical system to this home-centric geographical system? As you say, there are policies, there are plans in order to move this. So is this a case that Birdie is supporting this? And basically, where does Birdie fit in with realizing this vision?
Great question. So a couple of comments on what you just said. We're not going to change it all in one day. Hospitals and acute care will still be absolutely necessary, but in certain specific cases. One sure thing is that if you ask to any hospital, if you ask any hospital GP whether they would be welcoming to discharge patients earlier or to avoid hospital admission for some patients, they will obviously say yes right away. We know we have a significant capacity issue in hospitals, and one bed out of six is taken by an older adult who could have stayed at home had we seen signs earlier. So it's quite obvious that, you know, everybody has the same incentive to really shift some of the healthcare model towards the home where the patients live. So there's no conflict of interest here, and the hospital will remain, of course, because we need them desperately. But there's a lot more you can do where patients live, and that's where I'm saying we should rely more on the community. There's this kind of arbitrary distinction between health and social care in the UK, but that is just because of a budget decision a while back made to say NHS that's healthcare, social care is local authorities, and a bit of CCGs. The truth is, it's a single system of health and care to support the patients where they should be supported at best. And that's where we say the community can take care of a lot more. And that's actually happening at the moment via different channels, you know, whether we call it virtual wards or we code it in an accelerated discharge. There's a range of programs out there to really foster care in the community. A lot more is actually delegated to care providers in the community in terms of health and care provision, whether these are more elementary healthcare tasks or whether it's about taking on vital signs, because we don't need to mobilize a nurse or even a GP for such work. And actually, then you open up the ability to identify much earlier what's going on, diagnose faster through a GP. So this fluidity between health and social care to really shift healthcare towards the community is taking place and happening at the moment. Now, to your question, what's interesting is we see that in the community, it's a private market. We're talking about private care providers delivering care in the community, all types of care from companionship, you know, going in the house of a patient and an older lady and making tea for her, down to complex care or living care, where really you have a full-time person in the house of the patient because the needs are more complex. And these services, this care provision is delivered by private care providers, paid often by the NHS, by the CCGs, by the families, or by the local authorities. And so it's this tight network of private providers around the NHS picking up some of the work that the NHS cannot cope with anymore. And we at Birdie, we position ourselves as the partner for these providers to do the best job possible. And so really, we are this home care platform to support these care providers to deliver the best care by the best person at the best time in the most efficient manner. We are a full operating system for these care providers to run their operations, because there's a lot of time wasted today in organizing the care provision. And then making sure also that through the data and through the system and the digitization of the operations, we can actually significantly improve the care quality and help these care providers deliver the best care quality possible. But on top of that, for us, the ambition, the vision that we have is to go on the on a journey with these care providers to really, as I said, become the new primary care, the new frontline staff, as I said, so that community care becomes the first instance of care, and these care providers to be the first layer of care to support these patients before they're being sent to the hospital. And so we really bring everyone on this journey and help them get on this journey with us.
Interesting. So you mentioned the word operating system there, like you are the operating system behind these people on the front line, these services on the front line, delivering this community care. So I guess a bit of a more techie question. What are the things that you're supporting them with? What are the data points that you're creating in order to realize more and more efficiencies? Because I totally get it that by sitting all of these services on a digital infrastructure, the data that you will collect in order to make everything more efficient will be superb. What is it specifically that you're finding in the data, and how is that helping these people be more efficient? What are they getting more efficient with?
So you're absolutely right. There's always in the healthcare two tracks, I say. There's the efficiency gain track, and then there's the outcome improvement track, right? And often people rush towards the quality, but there's this kind of under the radar monster of inefficiencies in healthcare. We estimate that about 30% of healthcare costs are due to admin inefficiencies, right? So there's a lot you can do there to actually improve the efficiency. In a world where, at least in the community care world, we desperately need care workers to help. And so if you can save time for them to do admin so that they can care, because there's a waiting list of patients in need of care, everybody wins. And that's really what we're aiming for first. So let me start with that, the efficiency gain. When we last met, we were developing a first module of Birdie called Care Management, which really helped not only on the efficiency gains, but the care quality as well. Let me explain. When you had care workers going in the house of the patients three times a day to help them bathe, cook, walk, and take their medication, they were, and this many of them still today, use pen and paper for that to report their activities. So they would check in on paper, report which tasks they did, report medication given, report on paper any incident or concern seen, and then check out on that piece of paper as well. And that piece of paper would be brought back to the head office at the end of the week or sometimes the month, and, you know, looked at, typed into a Word document, printed out, archived, and then someone would audit these archives all day long and realize a month later that the carer didn't show up on time, or that the wrong medication was given, or worse, that there was a significant concern that was flagged, but not the head office was not called then. And so the first module for us was an app for the carers and a web app for the agency to really digitize all of that, the check-in, the check-out, the medication reporting, the clinical observations, and so on, meaning that you can see in real time what's going on. You can flag any issue. You can address these issues in real time as a care coordinator or as a care worker. But also, you don't waste as much time driving around, collecting that paperwork and typing it into a Word document. Or even, you know, you don't need back rooms of archives to keep these documents. And so that was the first module, and that was very well received by the industry, saying, fantastic, we gain efficiency, we improve quality of care. Then we moved on, since we last spoke, towards a wider platform, the full operating system, what we call the Build as One, where you can also cater for the scheduling, rostering needs of these agencies to really make sure that you have the right carer going to the right patient at the right time without wasting too much time in commuting, but also ensuring that this continuity of care and the right skill set to help that patient and to support that patient. And from there on, we went to side products, a bit of billing, a bit of payroll, third-party connections, a bit of quality and compliance, with the ambition that really Birdie is the single platform to run your entire business, to save time on admin, but as I said, also to significantly improve the quality of your care. And through that, it's been quite successful. So we today have more than 1,000 care providers using our solution day in, day out. It's really rewarding and exciting. And I think we appreciate the magnitude of our responsibility. When you go and see a provider using Birdie, you see, you know, 20 care coordinators behind the screen on Birdie all day long to manage their operations. And that is the exciting piece about efficiency gains and quality of care. That's in the UK. We also launched Germany, and we're working very hard to have the right product in Germany right now. And so that's been really the journey in which we embarked to fulfill that vision that I articulated earlier.
What have you learned about either this space or selling to that number of providers? Or the world changes a lot, doesn't it? Like the country changes a lot, the policies change, the markets change, the amount of money people have to spend on certain things changes. Lots and lots and lots of things change over this time, right? And actually, just even the fact that Birdie has been around for this long is arguably, you could argue, is unusual for a health tech company, because there's a lot of flash in the pan stuff. There's a lot of people that tried very early on that the startups fail. This happens. But, you know, you've raised Series A, you've raised Series B. Like, you've been around for a long time. I guess you've scaled to 1,000, I guess, B2B customers here. How has the space changed in that time? What have you learned?
Plenty of things, James. Yeah, and we listen. We're really proud of what we have achieved, and not to brag, but yeah, it's been a fantastic journey, and we're very privileged to be in the position which we are. You know, we really are excited about where we stand, and you know, we earn many, many awards for that as well, which really motivates the team. And so that's a great pride. But I'd say it's also quite rewarding because it means down the line that what we do and the solution we're developing are really helping. And that means a lot, right? I think to your question, I mean, there's a couple of aspects to your question. Number one is, what's the right healthcare tech, the health tech business model? And there's a few theses out there. We can talk at length about that. A software to support the care industry to be more efficient and deliver better quality care is for us a very compelling proposition and business model, because this industry hasn't digitized much yet. These providers are really keen to get the best solution for them to deliver the best care. And so that has been a very successful journey for us to bet on a B2B SaaS to support our partners and to really go with them on this journey of community care. And so you can look at other business models, which are sometimes more daring or probably more complex for a range of reasons, and which in the end were not as successful, I suppose. And there's no judgment there. I think everybody's trying, yeah. And really, I really hope that some of these models out there do succeed because we need them. What has changed to your question? I think there's a lot of things that have changed. In the end, we haven't seen a high during COVID of adoption of our technology or drop after COVID because people were going back into the physical world. We've seen this steady progression of tailwind because of one, these macro trends I explained earlier, aging population, shift towards the community, but also an easier adoption of technology overall, particularly with a population that sometimes was more tech adverse. And so we've seen this change in terms of, adoption of the app, embarking on the digital journey with us, using some of the analytics to manage their business better. All of that has accelerated because people feel much more comfortable with the technology. That's from the user standpoint. Now, at the policy level, change of government, money, and so on. The truth is, we say at Birdie that the cavalry is not coming. And we're close to both parties, and we've talked to enough health secretaries to understand one thing. The equation is really hard to square. If you look at the numbers, and we did the math, the NHS, the healthcare budget today in the UK is 165 billion, roughly. You could say 180 billion if you take it all in included. To match the healthcare provision quality of Germany, you should be at, 260 billion. So that means, from 160 to 260, another 100 billion pounds to actually deliver the quality of service that you would have in Germany. And Germany is good, but not exceptional either. There's no one, and that's healthcare. If you look at social care, the Health Foundation also released a report recently. You need another £8 billion in the next 10 years to keep the lights on social care. You need an extra £16 billion to actually cater for the needs of whoever needs care in the community in the UK. That's 1.5 million older adults extra. When you think about the magnitude of these numbers, you can try, but you're not gonna find £100 billion in this macroeconomic environment. And so, in the end, the solutions have to come from within. But we're quite hopeful. And that's what we're saying, that cavalry is not coming. We can ask for more money, but why not we try to find the solutions from within? Because if we, as I said, fluidify or ease this relationship, the relationship between health and social care, if we help to actually shift healthcare towards the community, if we incentivize the healthcare funding system towards outcome-based care, where we reward whoever keeps a patient better in better health, and we really pay for that, you will find the means from within for sure. And so that's really the narrative that we try to push, is we can call for extra money every day, but the equation doesn't square up. The amount is too large. Let's find the solutions from within. And there's plenty. And we see countless initiatives arising in the health and social care space. We have partners of ours, providers, actually working with ICSs and NHS trusts, saying, you know what? We're going to keep Mrs. Smith at home. We don't, and we will deliver hospital type care in the home, much cheaper for everyone. And she's much better off. We will discharge faster. Okay. Mm. And we will have a tight relationship with this trust so that we can discharge in one phone call instead of these endless conversations with different stakeholders. So there's lots of initiatives right now in the UK, but hundreds of them across the country, demonstrating the ability of health and social care to find solutions regardless of whether there's extra money or not.
It's really interesting. The cavalry isn't coming. It's a great mindset to be in, I think, no matter what, even if the cavalry might be coming. I think to take on that accountability for, like, I've actually just got to solve this problem, no matter what the national or international circumstances, is probably just a good place to start for an entrepreneur, quite frankly. Like, assuming that any single politician is going to change your personal circumstances is potentially quite a dangerous place to be.
No, but I want to say also, and what we see is, I have a strong conviction in a new narrative, but also obviously in, you know, demonstrating evidence of impact. And let me walk through the two of them. We deal in social care today with a range of providers who are often exhausted because they feel that they're not supported by the government and by the state. The margins are very thin. Local authorities are compressing the cost because themselves have very tight budgets. It is a tough environment to operate in. But what we do at Birdie is we really try to bring this narrative of, you are the future of healthcare. And so we've created, you know, a range of initiatives, including, you know, something called the flock and the nest, to bring these providers together, share the necessary resources and best practice, exchange about how to operate better as a care provider, understand the change in regulation, and so on. But that narrative of, there is actually hope, and you are at the heart of this transformation. You will be the future of healthcare. And that ability to provide a platform for that community to gather and not feel fully isolated is actually very powerful. And that's where we see a range of these initiatives coming up, as I said, because then they gather and say, well, actually, we can find solutions from within. And there's a range of them. And actually, it's very efficient and powerful. The second thing is, you know, on the cavalry is not coming, as I said, is you need to demonstrate the impact of it. And what I find exciting is that across the world and in the UK more and more, this element of outcome-based evidence, of evidencing that if you look not only at how many hours you care for a patient, but actually what's the result of the care provision on the patient, whether that's done by a GP, a nurse, or a care worker. If you look at that, if you observe that, if you demonstrate the evidence of the impact in a controlled fashion and with academic evidence backing it, I know that budget holders will wake up and say, wait, if actually that patient is better off and it costs me less, I will design the right incentives in place. It's a long journey. In the US, a bit ahead of us. In the UK, we've talked about it for ages. I strongly believe that with the ICSs, it's actually changing. But when you have a burning platform such as, you know, healthcare costs soaring, an NHS crisis that's mentioned every day in the newspaper, and when you have evidence of impact that you can bring the cost down and keep the patients better off, I know that this shift will happen.
So this actually neatly brings me on to my next question, actually, which is, how important do you think policy can be here? Because we want momentum and we want incentives that get us to a better place. We want to be able to realize this vision. And yes, okay, if we adopt the mentality that the cavalry isn't coming, we become fully accountable and we try and do things ourselves. Policy can still help us. Policy can still change the minds of people to behave slightly differently or to incentivize people slightly differently. So you've had conversations with health secretaries. I don't know if you can recall any of them and you've got any fun stories for us with those conversations, but you must think about this from a policy perspective too, of like, I don't know, how important do you think policy can be here?
Oh, I think it's critical. I mean, we operate in an environment where the bulk of the healthcare costs are regulated by the state, mm-hmm. or even provided by the state. So it is critical. What I'm saying is we should not wait forever for policy changes to, you know, proceed to some transformation within the system. And I also know that, the state as such will only react if there's enough evidence at sizable scale to transform. And so what we need to do, as I said, is to surface these examples and show that at scale it flies, because the state by inherently is one of the most risk averse, you know, body. You gotta innovation has to start from within to demonstrate it's possible. Now, you mentioned a couple of other things which I find interesting. I think also that as far as the model is concerned, this idea of delegating entire responsibility of healthcare to a limited set of people who have full authority on the health of the patients is something that will change. And this is more of a philosophical, you know, position here. But for a couple of reasons, when we looked at, you know, at the evolution of medical knowledge, typically, it's super interesting to see how today, you know, a medical knowledge has increased by a factor of 10 in the last 10 years, and physicians cannot keep up. And so one data point I love is that only 6% of what medical school graduates learn today will be relevant in 10 years. 6%. And if you combine that with the fact that we have an aging population who require a quite different type of care, because we're talking about comorbidities. So you have multiple conditions with adverse symptoms that are really hard to read, where we know that the health determinants are as important as the actual conditions. What I mean by that is you can give medication, but what you eat or drink or the kind of exercise you do or your mental health will be as important as this medication you take for that specific condition. These physicians are not equipped today to care for that population, and they're out of depth in terms of their knowledge very, very quickly. And so there's a couple of collaterals here. The first one is patients will need to take care of themselves as well. And there's a sense of responsibility here that healthcare is not just the authority of a doctor who has to fix you. You have to take care of yourself, particularly if you talk about non-medication factors such as exercise, food, and so on. That is a trend that will emerge. And I know that the state at some point will, put some of the responsibility on the shoulders of the patients themselves. The second thing is technology will play an important role in assisting these physicians in their job. And this is something that we're seeing already. And yes, we can talk about AI and LLMs, but there's various forms and channels, you know, emerging to show that this idea of co-pilot for physicians overall will be there. That whether that's through the data, early diagnostic, or, you know, note-taking, or delegating some of the work to care professionals who are less qualified but who are nudged via technology to take the right actions, we will see definitely more assistance from the data that's collected and the intelligence from that data for these physicians.
That's really interesting, the notion of responsibility. And actually...
I knew you would jump on that, James.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting, because what you've said there is that you're expecting, or we might see from the state, a shift in how they perceive responsibility. A very difficult political message that will have to go through a heck of a lot of Malcolm Tucker style spin, perhaps. But but one all the same that I think is incredibly important, if I stick my neck out and say that, because we've learned recently that information is a determinant of health. And actually, is it then the state's responsibility to inform everyone and educate people? Well, in part. But actually, if information is a determinant of health, then actually I can improve my health with access to more information. Now, of course, built into that, it's the fact that I'm privileged enough to have the time to dedicate to learning and to getting information, all those different things. And of course, all these things operate in a wild political spectrum of privilege versus responsibility, etc. But I think that is really key. I think we're seeing as well individuals, you know, our generation, generations below, or even just above, everyone seems more informed about their health. Perhaps that is just a middle-class thing. Perhaps it needs more work in different areas that I don't know. But my experience of people around me is that people are more informed about their health. And actually, you can see that bubble increasing, can't you? As our bubble moves upwards, yes, we will have more knowledge about our health. We will be more informed. We will make better decisions, all the rest of it. That doesn't change the bubble that exists currently in older adults and the burden of care that will increase and all the rest of it. But I just thought it was worth highlighting. I think what you've talked about there is a really difficult political message to get across. But if it does come across and it improves things, then it's probably quite useful.
But I think it's listen, we at Birdie, we want to be that platform to help community care take shape and be, as I said, the future of healthcare. We also talk about something that I really like, which is collective wisdom. So again, you know, if you look at an Italian village and you look at how children are looked after in a little Italian village, what you're going to see is that everybody, you know, calls each other saying, you know, your child had this, you know, he was eating at my place yesterday. That information helps to really look after this child in the best manner. That collective wisdom for us is the same when we think about community care. For older adults, but also not only older adults, whoever needs care in the community, frankly. If you can surface the information and coordinate and exchange that information in a seamless fashion, if you can, as I said, derive intelligence from that information to really indicate and guide people to look after these patients in the best manner, then you have a natural shift towards, you know, community care responsibility. And so I don't think the state will one day say, sorry guys, you know, now you're on your own and you're responsible. Mm. But what we will see is a couple of parallel factors. One factor will be state saying, well, we can only cope with the most serious diseases because our budget is flat and the needs are soaring. So all the rest, sorry, but look after yourself. And what we will see coming up is, you know, of course, you know, sadly, private healthcare and probably a dual system emerging, which I think is quite unequal. But you will also see people looking after themselves saying, you know what, actually, I'm in charge here and they will only look after me if something really bad is happening, but otherwise, I'd better look after myself. Combined with, you're absolutely right, there's more information available. For me as a patient, and that's great. And I think, by the way, the NHS is pushing very much for an NHS app, you know, that really gathers all the data of the patient, and that's fantastic. But also for the people around me who can really help me as a patient with greater needs to, you know, take the best care of myself. And so these two factors will, I think naturally push for towards responsibility of self-care. It's not a, you know, macro policy event that will make this happen. That's my
opinion. You're right. But it's actually not the responsibility of self-care, is it? It's the responsibility of community care. Because even my mind there goes to, like, I don't know, like what used to exist when I was a young kid, like the local community center, which had like a local, had an allotment out the back. And so you'd have like older adults out the back in the allotment, but then you'd have kids running around in the community center and, you know, a kid falls over or falls ill or whatever, or a parent asks an elder for advice. Like that, as long as the information is in that community, then that community can maintain its health better. And that goes for everybody. So it's interesting how my mind initially just went to, well, actually, the you know, information is the determinant of health. Well, that's the individual. The individual can learn, and then the individual can sort themselves out. Well, actually, this just goes back to us. Almost, it's just a socialist principle, isn't it? We should exist in communities, and we should help each other out. And there doesn't need to be a free market commercial element to that. It can just be that we enjoy being in a community and want to help each other out. Like, that's also okay. It's actually more than okay. It's actually much better for one's health and well-being for a myriad of reasons. Yeah.
We're really going down the tangent of philosophy more than technology, which I love it. But and you and I do that often, I've noticed.
If left our own devices, this is always going to happen, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And the editor will be like, well, come on, guys, once again. But I think so listen, my view on this is, there's a bit of a breach of, and we talked about that last time, I think, there's a bit of a breach of social contract. 100 years ago, you make kids, you look after your kids, you age the kids that look after you. And that has been kind of this social tacit contract and dynamics over the last centuries. Over the last 50 years, that has reversed a little bit, in the sense that hospices that were built in the 50s or even earlier in the 30s, really, these were kind of hospital for the elderly who didn't have any family member to look after them. It was a state stepping in with these horrible, you know, white walls and white color rooms for older people who didn't have any family to look after them, to say, well, we cannot let these people die in the street. We're going to actually take care of them. But that was a limited set of people. And then over time, you know, and blame it or not, but with, you know, a more capitalistic society and liberalism, it became more of a, this grew a lot, but also we started with private care homes, which were basically very much a place for people to be placed whenever the family members could not cope with the financial burden and or with the actual burden of having their parents with them on a day-to-day basis. That combined with urbanization and a few other factors where, you know, your parents stay in the village, you go in the city, and so you live far away from them. So range of factors. But you're right that today that contract is broken. This concept of community, which is extraordinarily powerful for a range of reasons, but including health determinants, older people feeling part of a community, contributing, looking after the kids on Wednesday evening, gathering on Tuesday because they're cooking together, I can tell you from a mental health standpoint, has as much effect as any Prozac or other medication, an antidepressant you can give. Very clearly. And we know that loneliness is one of the main factors, you know, with all the adults that drive to health deterioration. And so you're right. Community is very, very important. Now, we cannot reverse back to the past. I mean, that's not going to happen. So how can we try to mimic, or at least, you know, bring back some of these pillars and elements that used to be very powerful? And that's where we're saying, if we can empower the community to be better connected and to know what to do at all times, and then if we can bring these wider health determinants in the equation, then at least you bring back some of these, as I said, some of these elements or pillars that used to be very powerful for the community to stick together and these patients to live better off. And so I agree. The element of community has to be brought back. And we really want to empower that. That's what we're saying. We don't have this Amazon-esque view of one big fat care provider is going to, you know, care for your mom. And, you know, you don't have to take any responsibility here. They are part of the equation. But as long as the family members are, the GPs, the physios, the neighbors as well, so that everybody can really be in that tight village of care to look after these patients, regardless of where they are really. And that's where I think technology is very powerful, right? Because you can recreate some of this sense of connection, even if physically people are not in the same street.
Yeah. I understand the vision now a little bit more of what you're then trying to do, I guess. Well, you correct me if I'm wrong, but by strengthening the quality of care at that community level, you are then basically kickstarting this chain reaction of events that means that, you know, from a health perspective, okay, that those few people might not go to hospital for that referral, or they might not have that condition, all those different things. And then community care as a whole gets slightly better, slightly stronger. That attracts more funding, better policy. And all of a sudden you start to get some momentum of, like, you know, with all the virtual world companies or whatever it is, but like all these different initiatives that are strengthening community care, healthcare actually genuinely at some point down the line starts to feel like it is centered in the community and people are genuinely getting helped to stay in the community. The community gets stronger. The policy can then change towards it because people are seeing actual results. So I think what you're talking about is like Birdie sits at the very accountable beginning of, hey, we can strengthen community care. Here's all the things that we can expect down the line. Here's all the things that we actually care about as a company. We're a B Corp, we're this, we're that. These are things that we represent, these things we care about. And actually, by just kickstarting that chain reaction of events, you as a company, perhaps you as an individual as well, because I've seen some of the things you've been doing with your personal brand, you can then start to enact the change that you want to see in the world based on getting actual results for people, which is a position of strength in the area in which you work, if that sounds about right.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. You are the catalyst for change. And the bigger the vision, the more exciting it is, isn't it? But I agree with you that we think that the community will play an important role in the future for healthcare and for a wider, set of societal balance. But for healthcare, really, community will play an important role, and we can be the catalyst or the enabler for that, starting with the idea that if we can help everyone in that community to do a better job and to be better informed and to not waste time and to improve the quality of the care. Mm-hmm. And then second, to make sure that they're connected, they speak, and then know every one of them know what to do when and is informed at the right time and not to take the right action, because that's what's missing today. They just don't know. They are in the dark. They don't talk. They're frustrated about that. But the community is there. There's an army of people willing to help, willing to step in. And so that's the exciting bit for us. It's just the catalyst and the enabler that's missing.
So I have a question for you. So on the whole vision conversation here of like Birdie's vision goes far beyond what it could be, which is you could be, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but you could be a SaaS platform for care providers, full stop, end of paragraph, end of book. And that's what you could be. But you're very deliberate that you're all these other things, you're everything you've just talked about, the values of the company, the desire to become a B Corp, the vision that you have for what goes on beyond just that transaction. You sell a product to a care provider, and that is how you make money, which you then redeploy to pay your staff and to shareholders and the rest of it. Like, at the end of the day, like, you could just finish there. What have you noticed is the value of being all of these different things, of talking about all these different things, you as a leader caring about all these different things? And I want to be practical here, because people, you know, if I ask this question, people can say, oh, it helps with hiring because people want to be part of something, da, da, da. But like, in a concrete way, like, you might just turn around and say, because that's just who I am. Like, that's how I actually function best. I have to run a company in that way. I have to keep talking about the vision. But like, I don't know, why be the entire vision, and why not just be the SaaS platform for care providers?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a couple of answers to that, right? There's really three. One is because me, but my co-founders as well, and I'd say many people at Birdie, we're driven by this wider mission. That's what excites us. That's what, you know, makes us, you know, stand up in the morning, go to work on fire, resilient and determined. If it's a B2B SaaS play, you know, only with the outcome as a target to sell to private equity in with 3 years and make a financial exit, No, but listen, some people are excited about that, and I have no judgment. I have plenty of friends of mine in PE. But and maybe that will be the outcome if we fail with a wider vision and ambition, because it's quite ambitious. But you know, I don't think that would excite me, my co-founders, and the rest of the company as much. Second, and related to the first one, is because we see the magnitude of the problem, but also the magnitude of the opportunity here. I mean, it is incredible. You know, like when we look at the data, you know, we have, you know, 60,000 care recipients supported daily by care workers using Birdie. The number of things that we see in terms of health issues that are flagged earlier, concerns, the wrong medication given, and that all of these issues addressed by the care providers that we support is highly rewarding. We don't want to stop there. And so, you know, as I said, we see so many more opportunities in sharing the data with other stakeholders in the community to support family members who are struggling. We're talking 13 million informal caregivers in the UK. It's the untold heroes. It's the silent army. You know, it's the people who are not care professionals, but yet need to care for their mother or their father or their loved one. There's so much we can do to help them out. So we think that we have gold at hand here to support these people and really solve some of these macro problems. And that, you know, gets us on fire. And the third one is, it's a commercial element to it, right? We are entrepreneurs. So yes, we got a playbook that works fine for the moment. And yes, we absolutely obsessed to deliver the best value for our customers and our partners. But we think that as far as entrepreneurship is concerned, there's a wider commercial opportunity with these other ideas that we have to really shape up and fulfill that wider mission I explained. And we'll see. And maybe we'll fail. Listen, it's super hard. B2C, it's very hard. We talked about it earlier. I talked about value-based care. You know, we really want to invest in demonstrating the impact of using the data to keep the patients better off. There's no financial incentives for that. There's not a single person I talked to who tells me this bad idea, don't do it. But you know, we are entrepreneurs. We think there's also commercial value there. We'll experiment, but there's a huge problem to solve, and there's many solutions that we should try.
It must be an interesting position to be in, that it's almost like phase one of the plan has been executed, right? Like you've done the thing, like to some extent, and now it sort of gives you the belief of like, well, if I've done this thing, then, and I don't feel like I'm being grandiose here, but maybe I can change the world. Because actually, what we're talking about is a shift into this feeling and sense and very practical setting up of community and how people are treated within a community for the betterment of their health, right? And actually, you might have executed phase one. At phase five or six, this actually happens, and this actually happens at scale. And it happens at scale with a win-win of you and government and people and your shareholders and all the rest of it. There's a version of this where literally everybody wins. And like, I don't know, it's something about you as well, man. Like you're so good at getting even me excited about this. I say even me, of course, I'm interested in this in loads of different ways, but like I get a bit galvanized that I'm like, Christ, I want to work for you. What can I do to help? You know,
but come along, James.
I'm talking to Hannah, see if I can.
You know
work
where
for
we are. Yeah, you know the office.
Yeah, exactly. But, I do know the office.
No, I think, listen, you're right. It's a bit phase one. And I'll be honest, right? It's a grind every day. It is a grind every day. It's not like, you know, I wake up in the morning and say, oh, great, that's done. It's never done. We have a huge duty and responsibility towards our customers. You know, this is healthcare, and it's actually pretty serious healthcare in the sense that, one example, our rostering system is, you know, defining who's going to go to see what patient, which patient, when. If our rostering system is down or there are bugs, you know, there's thousands of care workers who will not show up to look after the patients and give the right medication. The responsibility is huge. The grind is there because we got to serve at best every single one of our customers. Mm. And I really mean it. And everyone at Birdie is clearly aware of that responsibility. But you're right. Phase one is on track in the sense that we got product market fit. So that means we are more on the rail track. We know where we're heading. The recipe works, and our customers are clear about what they want, and we believe that we're solving some of their pains. Phase two and phase three, you're right, are still very much on the ambition and the vision side. Mm. We haven't made it super concrete yet. We have a couple of ideas on how to experiment that, and we will activate that in the next 2 and 3 years. And it's a very long journey, but yeah, we're on fire, and we're really excited about this. And it's a we keep saying, you know, with the rest of the company, it's a generational company that we're building here. It's going to take a while. Mm. It's healthcare, but it's definitely worth it.
Generational company. It's so different when you start thinking in those timelines, isn't it? It's so different to consider it in those terms because A, you're less in a rush, and B, you kind of, you can believe it's possible over those sorts of timelines. And actually what it also means, I've noticed when I've experimented with this myself, is that the bumps in the road that we all get when growing a business, they seem less important when you have this kind of, you know, Simon Sinek quote, but like an infinite game mindset of like, yeah, okay, this might have happened now, but if I'm thinking this in over a 30 year timescale, if I'm thinking of exiting in 2.5 years, this actually becomes really relevant because this bump will be noticed on my P&L, and then the investors might not buy it. And to your point about private equity and all the rest of it, like, this is going to feel like a thing. But actually, if I take a 20-year, 30-year view on this, this doesn't actually matter that much. And actually, I relax a bit. And so it really is interesting thinking of things in infinite terms. And Simon Sinek does have a book, The Infinite Game, which is over there in the view that I haven't actually got finished yet. But yeah, it's really interesting.
I agree. And it's actually a very important point to make in the sense that if you take that long-term view, you're absolutely right. You live much better with the bumps along the road as long as you know that you are in the right direction. You're also there to make the bolder moves. And believe me, this stems every day. It really comes across our route every day in terms of are we optimizing for the shorter or the longer term?
Interesting.
From the platform we build, the architecture that we choose for, the people we hire. But then it's also, I'd say, in terms of resources, you need to plan for that as well. What I mean is the investors, pick investors who are in the long game with you, because otherwise they're going to have, they're going to put some pressure on you. And co-founders, right? I'm immensely privileged to have co-founders who are very much in the long run, in the long game with me. And so we have completely detached ourselves from the company. And so, I'm not a big fan of the, CEO who's fully associated with the brand. I think, on the contrary, it's a generational company we're building. Am I still around in 30 years? I hope not. But I know that other people will be for the sake of the mission we're serving, right? And that's exactly what we should aim for.
I love that. Just a really quick, more practical question. Why Germany as the next place you've gone?
I'm glad we're going back to business. Yeah. A couple of reasons, really. We looked at, and I think it requires a bit of an explanation on how you think about geographic expansion in a healthcare SaaS business. Because in the end, we're not Slack. and so going abroad in another location is not just about localizing the language and the currency and maybe a couple of GDPR topics. It's actually, replicating part of your solution because every country works differently, even if you are there as a B2B SaaS solution. And so as part of the criteria to go to the next country, and we wanted to go international because we want to create an international business. Also because we believe that with that, we will have more data to shape this kind of personalized preventative care journey that I mentioned earlier. We wanted to pick a large country with a large number of potential clients because we knew we had to probably rebuild part of the product anyways. Right. And so this is how we selected Germany, saying, well, it's the largest addressable market for us in Europe. And, you know, whether we go in France or Italy or Spain or Germany, in any case, we will have to rebuild part of the product because there are specificities in each geography. Germany is by far the largest. A market structure that's very similar, a type of client that's very similar, an old incumbent that we have firm intention to displace. And so we picked up that country. And we'll see, right? This is about, you know, the risk we're taking as well, right? I mean, to be honest, Germany has been, you know, a very difficult market for many health tech companies, French, Swedish, British companies. I mean, health tech scale-ups moving to Germany, it's been a very, very hard journey for many of them. So we know what we're up to, but really believe that's the right move for us. And then we have ambitions to go even beyond, and we're looking at a few other geographies that could be exciting for us.
Love it. Max, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast again, as always. For those people that want to get in touch with you, learn a little bit more about Birdy, what is the best way for them to do so?
They can actually go on a website. It's www.birdy.care. And from there on, you can, you know, contact us. You can look up, you know, what we do, the vision, the ambition, the blogs. If you want to work with us, there's a career page, but all of the info is there.
Perfect. I will say, mate, it is always a pleasure because I always leave these conversations just so energized. And I'll spare you the usual emotive summary that I normally do.
Yeah, do.
Because you really took the piss out of me at Google for doing that. So
I did that indeed. Yeah.
But no, it is a genuine pleasure, man. Like you honestly get me fired up. You get me fired up for doing this stuff. And I'm sure, well, I know for a fact you run a wonderful company and you have a lot of people on the mission with you. So I wish you all the best. I'll speak to you soon.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks so much for the opportunity. Really, really loved this chat as always. Have a lovely afternoon.
Hey everyone. Thanks for listening and making it all the way to the end of this episode. Remember to subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. And you can head to the description of this episode to follow me on all of my social media so you don't miss out on any of the latest health tech content.